So, okay, so let me say I'm going to start this talk basically with going through some stuff that's been around for a little bit now, primarily focusing on the gravitational wave observation from 2017 and the LVC contributions to the analysis of that, necessarily not going into many of the other approaches that have either built on released data from the LVC analyses or done their own independent analyses, but I just want to highlight a few things on, in particular, some updates in the recent catalog paper to some of our fundamental measurements coming onto the equation of state, and then going back a little bit to the radius equation of state in the context that Nils and Cole talked about it earlier. So actually some of this result will be like what Cole did, but not quite as good. So please erase that from your memory to go back to where we were, when an alternate path building up to some similar posterior distributions, and showing you actually some of the structure that goes into those measurements and where the limits of our understanding and modeling are right now, which is something different a little bit than the previous talks. Okay, so when we're talking here about the tidal deformability of a neutron star, it's easy to conflate this with radius because they are behave in a very similar fashion. In particular, this tidal deformability for a given star is primarily scaled by radius to the fifth power. So the most equation of state impact on the tidal deformability comes from the radius. The way we define tidal deformability as used in this entire context is from a linear perturbation of the star. So we're talking about an isolated star in an external tidal field. You can define this parameter for a given mass and equation of state that quantifies how much the mass within the star shifts and changes the gravitational potential around it. And so the difference of mass within the star shifting and outer radius shifting kind of comes into this parameter here called the Love number, which is a component of the tidal deformability distinct from the radius. And so that's going to have some range that where two equations of state with the same radius may not have the same tidal deformability, although in general these things are closely related by quasi-universal relations. So we have then a family of equations of state is one way to think about it. In general, the spread of the tidal deformability parameter tracks the spread of the radius. They have for a given model for the nuclear physics with whatever precise parameters get put into that model, you have a linear relationship, not linear, you have a functional relationship of pressure and density in the cold region that describes neutron stars that will then map to a sort of relationship between mass and these characteristic parameters of single stars. Okay, so that's how we start out. Now, where does this come into a gravitational wave signal, which is not single stars anymore? A gravitational wave signal like, so this is a bit of an update of the plot Nils showed now with real signal. We have some sort of in-spiral here of a gravitational wave signal plotted in terms of something that you can compare usefully with the amplitude of the noise in the detector at the time of 170817, or the design noise sensitivity of our goal advanced LIGO detector. We have a signal here that starts out, comes into 15 hertz when it's still got 6 minutes of in-spiral left to go. It spends a lot of time, it gets to here, and it has now 30 seconds of in-spiral left to go at 40 hertz. But eventually, the stars start to approach each other enough that the size of the separation of the orbit approaches the scale of the matter of the star, and at that point, you start to get a tidal influence on the devolution of the system, which starts to come in and becomes most strong starting here around 450 hertz, which is the last 30 milliseconds of the gravitational wave signal. The amplitude of these frequency diagrams is high on the low side because there's a lot of cycles there, Here, by the end, we're sweeping rapidly through this frequency phase, and we start to see amplitude differences here in these different signal models, which are coming from a range of equations of state and numerical simulation, coming from the tidal interactions accelerating the merger of the star, and then eventually the surfaces colliding. So if these were, for example, 14-kilometer surfaces, and you use a very rough Keplerian orbit estimate, the surfaces hit each other right about here, which maybe gives you a back-of-the-envelope understanding of why we're pretty confident these weren't greater than 14-kilometer stars, no matter how you drill into the data. Because if they were more than 14 kilometers, we would have seen the surfaces or the impact of not being in spiral anymore earlier, before the noise fluctuations at high frequency rose above the signal. And then there's also this exciting post-merger thing where we're no longer cold, well described by a single tidal parameter, although people have tried to, you know, use universal relations to get around that. We have a very interesting and messy region, which is so far just an upper limit from anything we've seen, that is likely not going to be interesting until we get another order of magnitude improvement in the gravitational wave sensitivity. Okay, so what does the imprint of matter on a gravitational wave look like? And I wanted to talk about this a little bit more in detail because this comes into the confidence you might have that a gravitational wave measurement has a robust physical meaning when it comes to translating data recorded by the interferometer into something we can say about nuclear matter or high-density matter in a neutron-rich regime. And something that is key to realize is that right now we are relying on our ability to parameterize the full gravitational waveform through that in-spiral and tidally influenced region by a waveform development that is parameterized by the masses and the spins that any of you that work in black holes should be very familiar with, along with only one extra parameter per star. And like Nils said, there was no way a priori to assume that this would be something sensible or reasonable or even useful to do, but as it turns out, to the level of our accuracy of resolving numerical simulations, we cannot distinguish effects on the waveform which are not captured by variation in these tidal parameters. So for now, in this era of gravitational wave physics, these are our state-of-the-art models. There's two kind of all the physics we know incorporated into them ways that we model the gravitational wave signal. Step one is just to kind of phenomenologically model or modify binary black hole mergers. So we have a really pretty robust understanding of the gravitational dynamics of binary black hole merger now, coming not maybe some part from analytical models, but also from very high precision, robust, convergent numerical relativity simulations. So that is understood. And, you know, up to, say, 5 or so years ago, the limiting systematic error on making these measurements would have been, I would have said, uncertainty in the high order interactions of point particles in general relativity. But I think we have that pretty well under control now. The next step, though, is to first off put in the leading analytic tide, which I think actually we also believe in pretty robustly. And that drives the majority of what we measure in a gravitational wave signal, just the take a Newtonian gravitational potential to form a star with these relativistic parameters, you get a correction at leading order that there's not too many ways you can mess that up creatively without introducing a weird scale in the in-spiral or something like that. But we know that when we look at numerical simulations close to the merger, where all the numerical simulations agree, the simulation data over-predicts, or let's see, the leading order term under-predicts the effects of matter that we see as the stars merge. And so we can either do a phenomenological fit to numerical relativity to just capture that in our tidal correction. Or we can say, well, why would these, what else is going on? And you can step by step go through a wide range of higher order terms that are in some ways universal relations related back to the in-spiral parameters that quantify how higher order effects in the tidal potentials and the response of the star, other resonances with the orbit and the oscillation modes of the star. So step by step, these can be incorporated into models. There's two main sort of families of doing it. And so we have, between bracketing the BBH uncertainty, bracketing variation in reasonable tidal models, we have a pretty good handle on systematics. So we can say right now we are not systematics limited in what we say about neutron star matter, although it's an important factor. It's non-trivial. It's not negligible in what we can extract from the signal. So what can we extract from the signal? So this is from the Gravitational Wave Transient Catalog paper update, which is when you actually go to analyze the signal, similar to effective spin in the black hole case, there is a single tidal parameter that captures the leading order behavior imprinted on the gravitational wave signal, which is mainly the thing you measure. Actually, it is the thing you measure. You don't really measure. If you take this combination of parameters and then you take the other combination, the signal data is uninformative about the other combination. This is what you get. Okay, so we get this leading order combination of tidal parameters and masses. We put this into the family of waveforms, and you get some posterior distribution of values of this parameter that come out of comparing those waveform models with the data. So first off, this is just a very eyes wide open first look at the data, where we don't make any assumptions about how the two stars might be related, whether they're black holes or neutron stars. We allow for the possibility of neutron stars in each case, but we don't assume anything going in. And then there's some technical details, but we get sort of these fairly robust upper bounds on how much the star can deform. These are the two analytic models with higher order terms put in as much as possible. This is the one fit through the numerical data. And this is sort of our post-Newtonian baseline that we started out with, because all of this waveform infrastructure was only developed in the last couple of years. Okay. So this is one thing, but something to notice is, just like the masses are primarily measured in a combination, and the ratio of masses is very degenerate with the spin, this measurement is also degenerate with the spin measurement of a neutron star. So aligned spins get the stars to merge quicker, tides get the stars to merge quicker. There's some conflation of the two in the data that is not possible to distinguish. And some of the results you get with this broad consideration of spins are maybe not what you would be interested in if you're like, look, this is a 1.35 solar mass system of a binary that's merging. We have seen a lot of those, and we know something. They don't, from our understanding of formation, spin very quickly. So we can then assume that the spins are small, that they are in the range observed in binary neutron stars in our galaxy. And this is where you might say that we have a separation from zero. So you do some sort of highest probability density credible interval with these different distributions, and you get a range that we actually currently use as our fiducial model when we're saying, what did we learn about the equation of state? Because I think it's not, you can consider other scenarios, but low spinning neutron stars is not very weird to think about. So you get, I think for the IMR phenom P and RT, you get this distribution that we quote, and then you can see how those bounds can shift around with other waveform modeling things. That's the level of waveform systematic error going into this measurement. And that can push the lower bound on the credible interval down to zero with one of the waveform models. Okay, so that's where we are. This is, what's favored by how much compared to other ranges. And then something that I haven't mentioned yet is we're also here comparing to some fiducial equation of state models, where these shaded regions here are constructed by taking the masses that are inferred from the same gravitational wave signal analysis, piping them through an equation of state into component tidal deformabilities and plotting the resulting distribution. So this is a way to compare what these posterior ranges look like compared to, you know, how much they might favor one equation of state over another. This isn't really the right way to do that. One way to do that might be to do a nice model selection kind of criteria, but, you know, as you can see, the range here is very broad, and so unless you're one of these nuclear physicists and you have a strong idea about what the right model is that you want to compare to the data, maybe you want to take a more less model-specific approach to what you're doing. Okay. So this is the spectral equation of state thing that Cole also talked about. So this is actually the posterior distribution, but it gives you an idea of how we're probing a range of pressure density relations in the core of the star by allowing these things to fluctuate in this parameterized way, but really what we're interested in is the functional form of pressure as a function of density at the core of the star. So we assume here only that it's sort of pinned down at around half nuclear density, and that it behaves some fairly fundamental relations like causality, and that the speed of sound is not greater than one in dimensionless units, that it's not greater than the speed of light. And so we can then go back to the equation of state analysis, and in particular with this common spectral parameterized equation of state describing both the stars, you restrict down to this smaller region, which you can also do without referring to a concrete equation of state description, but relying on just direct universal relations between the two components within a binary system described by the same equation of state that's developed in this Chatsiano et al. Paper and uses some of Ken Yagi's universal relations underpinning it. And these both give really consistent results, okay? Gravitational wave data, common equation of state, gives a consistent result. This is also consistent with Shomi's work with Duncan and Ido, where you can say, like, there's a narrower range on what's allowable when you assume the two stars are related. I wanted to step briefly through going from these tidal measurements to radius. So this is a second step. Really, what the gravitational wave models are informed by is tidal deformability. To go to radius, you can either add in some universal, quasi-universal relationship between the component tidal deformabilities and radius. So that ignores the effect of the Love number, but it actually works pretty well for most equations of state. Or you can take the same equation of state favored in your parameterized analysis and use it to generate radii for each sample, and that gives you a distribution of radii. So you start to see here, this is a little bit different ordering than Cole's, so we start off with some weak nuclear constraints and causality, and we're already actually really, this lower limit is not as much set by the data, although in particular, the universal relations do accommodate smaller stars than are favored by the data. But the lower limits here quickly begin to be set by nuclear physics and by fundamental understanding of the causal relations, of the causal structure of matter in the star. And really, you then want to add mass, which we do in the way that Cole says we shouldn't do, but it was the easy thing to do, which is just to do a hard cut at 1.37, and that shifts the lower bound at radius further. So the information that you get from gravitational wave data plus a hard cut at 1.97 solar masses is this, this distribution here, which is shifted from, say, the gravitational wave data alone, because we've actually just taken like this big peak here and said, actually, if we translate those into equation of states that are smooth, they don't support stars that we know exist. So that sampling is unphysical in that particular sense. Okay, so then we get something where gravitational wave data pushes us to low pressures at lower densities. Having to support large mass stars pushes us to higher pressures at higher densities, and some competition between these effects gives us what we can say about neutron star matter. And then it's important to say that this is perhaps less informative and overlaps X-ray data from 2010. So this is not a surprising measurement, but it is useful because it is not surprising, because this is an entirely different set of systematic uncertainties than you might be worried about with interpreting X-ray bursts. So this is consistency of astrophysical interpretation more than new knowledge. I should say, well, I will say later some other things. Okay. Obviously. No, I'm done now. That's it. No, nothing is next. We're done. Go home. No. Okay, obviously 1708-17 was not what we hope to be the end of the story of what we learn about neutron star equation of state from gravitational waves or other things. So, first off, we're looking to improve the high frequency sensitivity, and that is directly related to how well we'll be able to constrain these tidal effects in the last 30 milliseconds or so of the signal at that high frequency. And if you look at where we are here, where we have been, where we're aiming to go, there's a big chunk of range there that was really exciting if you want to hopefully see 1708-17 again in the design era, or something similar to it, of course. And we also have rates here, which bracket a range from the recent catalog paper that actually agree with the 2010 projection of around 40 per year observable with advanced LIGO design. So this is nice. Okay, rates are on track with what we expect. There's a potential for more signals. This rate also says that 1708-17 was like a top few percent signal, so that's maybe, you know, hold your horses if you're basing your entire interpretation of what these are going to look like on that one. Not likely going to be the case, which we've actually already seen. So when we start to see, say, something like this trigger, 1904-25Z, which disappointingly had a very, very wide error box for trying to follow it up electromagnetically, but we do have gravitational wave data. Unfortunately, this was at 156 megaparsecs. And I'm throwing up this messy figure here from a paper that Ian and I wrote, basically to say that these lines here are where the signature of a conservative tide is one sigma fluctuations in noise. So this is like the border of where it's conceivably imprinting on the signal. And this is sort of 150. So Don't hold your breath on being able to see anything differently exciting from this new trigger, with all the appropriate caveats for analysis still in progress to validate the data and all that sort of stuff. So measurement error, though, depends on the distance. So really, if we want to get a lot of advanced LIGO signals with very interesting sensitivities to tidal the deformability, if we want to measure a lower bound, we're going to have more luck on the small mass side. If we want to measure things on the high mass side, it better be really close. So that's disappointing, though, but at least NICER might have a high mass information to give us there. Right. And then Shomi was on this paper with some folks, Forbes et al., that just recently said, well, really, from nuclear physics, we know as much as you've learned from the 1708-17, but with one nicer observation, this is error on the pressure as a function of density here. Nicer observations will start to pin this down. Another LIGO observation will make some impact, which might be not much or could be a good bit, but once you get, say, 15 or 100 LIGO signals, this starts to bring our information up into the high density regime in an interesting way. Okay, so am I stopped talking? Okay, I will stop by just saying, of course, we hope this isn't the end of the story. Higher design will have an improvement on these measurements as well. Thank you.
Any questions? questions or comments for Jocelyn?
So you mentioned that in the future, like, well, could you comment on like the two configurations, like the design LIGO sensitivity versus the BNS optimized? So in terms of informing the tidal signatures, optimizing over range, does that necessarily optimizing over time?
Yes. Yeah, so there's this BNS optimized. So I actually do not like that, BNS optimizing, though I really like BNS, and that's because this is optimized to give you the most number of signals, and the SNR accumulates sort of in here. And then the tidal information sort of starts to ramp up and then dies off as the signals end kind of over this range. So this is where we're interested in measuring tidal signatures. Now, you do get a bit of a trade-off. If you get a lot more signals that you're confident in, you might be able to do interesting stacking things, but I think most things show that it's the few best signals that are most informative, and you want the high frequency to do that well.
Just to comment on that, I would say ignore the BNS optimized curve. It will never happen in advanced LIGO. We've been discussing this in a 3G context. It requires detuning the signal recycling cavity in advanced LIGO, and there's no plan to do that because squeezing does better. So squeezing will get you the high frequency, so just pretend that purple line doesn't exist.
Questions?
I can make a comment and a question. So the comment is that maybe truncating at some maximum mass is not a terrible idea because there is some evidence from the observed distribution of neutron star masses that there could be a maximum mass cutoff in the distribution that it's bimodal with a sharp cutoff. And the question that I had is there any understanding of the apparent bimodality in the distribution of lambda and so in the distribution of the radii?
So you can see here that this comes in particular when we use this numerically calibrated tidal formulation, which I actually think includes the most physics, so maybe that's something you want to do, but that's arguable. And so if you do get some structure in the other waveform models, but it's not picked out as abruptly, it's not clear, like it doesn't come from a clear one wave cycle overlap or something like that in the high frequency, as best as we can tell. It's something you do see in Gaussian noise, sometimes randomly. Les Wade has done a lot of studies like that back with Ben Lackey, and they saw similar distributions on occasion from noise. That's about as much as I can say right now. I wish we had a better answer. We periodically kind of go and puzzle over it a little bit.
Other questions or comments? If not, let's thank Jocelyn again.